Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Victoria Thorpe, sitting in for David Onick and Joseph Pache. Tonight we're talking about early onset of puberty in girls and the latest research about what may be causing girls to start puberty younger than ever before. Girls across the country are beginning to mature as young as 8 years old, according to new data just published from a study of over 1,200 girls in the Bay Area, Cincinnati, and New York. While the study is still exploring why the age that puberty begins is edging down, doctors have identified obesity as one possible factor. The study also shows that race and ethnicity matter for when a girl starts puberty. What is behind the downward trend in maturation for girls of different races and ethnicities? Why is obesity linked to early puberty for some girls? What are the other environmental and social issues that may be triggering the start of puberty? And what should parents and teachers do to help young girls adapt to their changing bodies? Joining me tonight to explore these questions and more are three lead investigators from the Bay Area who are involved in this national study. Here in the KALW studio, we have Dr. Louise Greenspan. Dr. Greenspan is a pediatric endocrinologist at Kaiser Permanente in San Francisco and a co-author of the national study about early onset of puberty in girls. Dr. Greenspan has been at Kaiser since 2001, where she specializes in treating diabetes and other chronic conditions in children. She also teaches at UCSF Medical School. Welcome, Dr. Greenspan.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Juliana Deerdorf is an assistant professor in the Maternal and Child Health Program at UCSF and the King Sweezy and Robert Womack Endowed Chair in Medical Science and Public Health. She is a clinical psychologist and a co-investigator for the Bay Area Cohort Study of Early Onset of Puberty in Girls. Dr. Deerdorf focuses her treatment and research efforts on adolescent sexuality and reproductive health and is studying the impact of stress on adolescent development. Welcome, Dr. Deerdorf.
Thanks for having me.
And by phone, we have Dr. Lawrence Cushy. Dr. Cushy is the Director of Scientific Policy at Kaiser Permanente Northern California Division of Research and the project leader for the Bay Area cohort of the National Study of Early Onset of Puberty in Girls. Dr. Cushy is internationally recognized for his expertise in nutritional epidemiology, and his research interests focused on the role of diet and nutrition on coronary artery heart disease and breast and other cancers. He has served on various American Cancer Society committees to develop guidelines for the dietary prevention and management of cancer. Welcome, Dr. Cushy.
Thank you.
Thank you, all three of you, for being part of City Visions Radio tonight as we discuss the implications of this important study of young girls. At about midway through our show, we'll start taking calls from our listeners, and the number to call will be 415-841-4134, and that's 415-841-4134. If you have a question now about early onset of puberty in girls, you can send us an email to cityvisions917@gmail.com or post a question on the City Visions page at kalw.org. So I want to start by having our guests, who are so intimately involved in this interesting study, introduce themselves in a little more detail and give our listeners a little bit of a lens on the roles that you each play in the study. And Dr. Greenspan, I'd like to start with you.
So I'm one of the co-investigators on the study. I'm the only pediatric endocrinologist. So my involvement is really being a specialist in girls' pubertal development and in making sure that we're measuring that correctly, and also in teaching and training the staff, because one of the unique aspects of our study was that we had all the girls were examined, and that's something that's new and different, and I was involved in that.
And why don't we just step back, I should have said this before, but and give us a little bit of a timeline where the study, when the study began, what the point in the study's sort of lifetime you are now, and then also who funded it, and where, you know, what the, maybe just a quick explanation of its origins.
Yeah. So this is studied, this is funded by the National Institutes of Health, specifically NIEHS, which is the Environmental Health Sciences part, and NCI, the Cancer Institute. And we started in 2005 by recruiting across the country in three sites 1,200 girls. And what that's one of the unique aspects of this study, that we're following these girls longitudinally or through time. Most of the other studies done on pubertal development are done on one group of girls of all different ages. And this is unique because we've been following them through time. So they were 6 to 8 years of age when they were recruited in 2005, and we are in year 8 now, and we've been seeing the girls once a year.
Okay. And there's about 400 of them in each of the three locations?
Yes. San Francisco started with the largest group. We had 444.
Okay. And then the other two locations are Cincinnati and New York.
That's right.
Okay. Great. Well, we're going to get so much more into the study, but that's a helpful overview. And Dr. Dierdorf, would you give us what's your point of the contact with the study?
I'm also a co-investigator, as Louise is. I'm a clinical psychologist, though, and I focus on adolescents. I'm actually at UC Berkeley, not UCSF.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
And I'm an assistant professor there, and I specialize in adolescent health. So what I bring to this study is an understanding of kind of the psychosocial environment the girls are growing up in and how that might influence the timing of puberty, and then kind of subsequently how early puberty may influence mental health and psychological outcomes downstream, and also sexual outcomes.
Okay, great. I apologize for that mistake. Dr. Dierdorf is from UC Berkeley, a very important difference. And Dr. Cushy, could we hear a little bit about, I know you are the lead investigator for the Bay Area cohort, but we'd love to hear more about your involvement in the study.
Yeah, sure. So as you mentioned, I'm the principal investigator for the study. And we wrote this research grant back in 2003 or so, and were funded, as Dr. Greenspan mentioned. We started enrolling girls back in 2005. So my interest in the study really comes from the underlying rationale for why this study was even started. It's part of what the NIEHS and the NCI calls their Breast Cancer in the Environment Research Program. Prior to starting this study, I'd been involved in a number of studies looking at diet and physical activity and risk of breast cancer in adult women. So women in their 30s, 40s, 50s, when women start to develop breast cancer. So the rationale for this study was that we know that early age at menarche in particular, but early puberty is associated with long-term breast cancer risk. And so this provided the research community, and me in particular, the opportunity to look at early life events and whether what factors are associated with differences when those occur, and with the underlying rationale that there may be some relationship with long-term breast cancer risk.
Yeah, that was one of the most interesting things that I learned in doing the research for the show, was the relationship between early, getting your period early, menarche, as you described it, and later risk for breast cancer. And the interesting part of this study is it's really unwinding backwards over such a long period of time to really figure out all of the touch points along that long line that would potentially influence that risk factor. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So I guess I should clarify that we're never actually going to study breast cancer in this particular study. It's really focused on puberty per se and the pubertal transition, so really trying to understand all the different hallmarks of sexual maturation and factors that may influence when that occurs.
Right, that's an important clarification. Yeah, you won't be able to follow these girls all the way into their 40s and 50s, but certainly to understand the relationship between when they go through their first period and tracking backwards to when that process begins.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's get into the key findings. And there was a big paper you all published just a few weeks ago. Some of our listeners may have seen the article in the Chronicle about it. Let's share with folks what were the key findings that came out of this point of the study, the data that you looked at, and what are the most salient points people should understand of what you know so far about early onset of puberty. You want to start with you, Dr. Greenspan?
Yeah, so this particular paper that came out on November 4th was looking at the average age of breast development broken down by ethnic group. And we had previously published a paper on what percent of 7 and 8-year-olds had pubertal development. But this is a later time period, and we were able to look at the group as a whole and look at the average age of breast development. And what we found was that breast development is starting earlier than had been previously described, particularly in overweight girls, and that difference was marked now in the Caucasian girls. It has been well described in African-American girls in the past, but now it really seems like this is a factor in the especially in the obese Caucasian girls. So what we found was at this point, in the African-American participants, the average age of breast development was 8.8 years. The Hispanic participants, it was 9.3 years. And in the white and the Asian participants, it was 9.7 years.
And what about the girls who hit that point of obesity in their body mass index? What was the average age for them?
So the girls that were obese were on a track that was earlier the whole way along.
Okay.
So if we were to break it down, the girls that are obese look like it may be adding 6 months to a year, particularly at the early age. So the more obese you are, the more likely you are to have breast development at a younger age. So that was particularly relevant at, say, age 7 or 8.
Okay. And just so our listeners are getting a real picture of what this means, maybe you could just define for us what breast development means within the context of your study.
Yes, I think it's a misconception that, or miscommunication sometimes between those of us who do research in this field and the general public. When I talk about puberty, I mean the onset of breast buds, which are palpable or something you can feel, and parents shouldn't be feeling this, but this is something the pediatrician examines, and it's glandular tissue. It feels different than breast tissue. And when you look at it, you can't always tell the difference, but a pediatrician or a trained researcher or a research associate can palpate or feel it and tell the difference. And that glandular or firm tissue is the true onset of breast development. We've also looked at pubic hair development in our study. So when the lay public hears puberty starting early, they think periods.
Yes.
And we're not talking about 8.8-year-old girls getting periods. Yes. We are in the process of being able to collect that data, and that paper will come out in a couple years, hopefully, a year or two. But this is really looking at the mark that we feel endocrinologists and other researchers feel signifies estrogen levels that cause this breast development. And that's a true milestone in pubertal development scientifically.
Yes. Okay. So I think that's an important clarification. So the key points, just to state back, are that the age is edged down, mm-hmm. and that being obese seems to be a trigger factor, mm-hmm. if I can use that word, and that you're seeing that across all races and ethnicities.
Yes, there's still an ethnic differential, mm-hmm. But the more obese you are, the earlier you are going to go into puberty, whatever your ethnicity is.
Okay. And Dr. Cushy, since you are in charge of the Bay Area cohort, one thing I understand is unique about the group here in the Bay Area is that you have Asian girls in the mix. And maybe you could explain any differences that you saw amongst the girls from that ethnic background.
Yeah, so that's correct. Our 400 girls basically reflect the population of the Bay Area, so it's multi-ethnic. And so we have African-American girls, Hispanic girls, Asian girls, as well as white girls. The girls in Cincinnati are largely white and African-American, and the girls in New York were purposely enrolled so that they are largely Hispanic and African-American. So our study was really one of the first studies in the U.S. to look at Asian girls and describe age at onset of breast development. And so what previous studies have demonstrated and we confirmed is that African-American girls in the U.S. do appear to start breast development earlier than white girls. There's been a couple of studies that have looked at Hispanic girls as well, and they seem to fall intermediate, and that's what we confirmed as well. Our Asian girls, as you mentioned, there's the first study that has actually included Asian girls in the United States. They seem to be to mature around when the white girls do, and if anything, perhaps slightly later. So some of this may be due to some of the population obesity or body mass index differences, but that's some of the things that we're trying to also try and unravel. Why are these racial differences occurring?
Okay. Well, since you asked the why question, I think that's what everybody wants to know. So maybe we should just go there and talk a little bit about what you're starting to, you know, wonder about, what you're looking into, and what are the sort of questions you're investigating in terms of this whole trigger and factor question. So we've already gotten a couple of comments on our webpage about environmental factors. And so why don't we just talk a little bit about that and talk about what you know and maybe what you still want to know about those questions. And I don't know, maybe Dr. Greenspan, we'll start with you, but I'm sure you all have things to say about that.
Actually, yes, I think all three of us represent probably the major environmental areas that we're looking at. So I'm sure we all need to comment on this. I think one thing I just want to mention is that when we define the environment, we might define it differently than other people. So when we define the environment, we're defining it not just the chemicals you might be exposed to, but also the food that you eat and where your home is located, how much pollution you're exposed to, as well as who's in the home. Mm-hmm. So the environment is a large piece of it. I think some people think of the environment as purely as chemicals, and there are certainly many chemicals that we are investigating. We have done dietary records, so all the girls tell us what they're eating and whether it's organic and what brand it is and where they eat and what restaurants they eat at. But we've also measured we've also collected their urine where we can measure levels of chemicals. So we are looking at pesticides, flame retardants, and many other kinds of chemicals that may be related to endocrine disruption. And also two of the main ones we're looking at is also bisphenol A or BPA and phthalates. And Dr. Khushi can also sort of explain some of the other chemicals that we're looking at. But we are also looking at the environment, and I think the social environment. I think Julie can talk a little bit about the social environment.
Yeah, I was just about to say, I want to come back to that because it's sort of those the hot button questions people have about BPA and things like that. So we're not going to let that drop. But I think it's really interesting, Dr. Deirdre, some of your research about the environmental, described the way Dr. Greenspan just did, factors that really do have a play a part in how girls go into puberty and when they do.
Sure. And when you see these type of health disparities going on that are broken down along ethnic lines, it really leads someone like me, who's both a psychologist and also has a strong belief in social factors, to wonder what's going on for certain ethnic groups that might cause them to live in environments that aren't as healthy. So we've already mentioned things like overweight, and we know that there is an overrepresentation of overweight among Black and Hispanic girls in our country for many reasons that are very structural, like access to healthy foods and overrepresentation of poverty, perhaps limited access to physical activity opportunities. And so I think we're accounting for some of that and looking at it even in this first article. What I hesitate, though, what I really want to communicate, and I hesitate for people to just latch onto, is that this is a racial difference, that because because Black girls are Black, they therefore are going to go through puberty early, and that's inevitable because there's so many environmental factors that African-American girls are overexposed to in our environment. And we can talk more about some of those as well.
I think that's an important difference, that it's not hardwired into who they are. It's more about the situation that they're growing up in. And maybe just name a couple of things that you're looking at from a psychology point of view.
Well, one of the things that I think of, even though it's more about the built environment, is does a girl have a place to exercise regularly? Is it safe in her environment to get out and walk about? Is there a lot of dysfunction in the home? There's some evidence that if a home environment isn't nurturing and warm, that the body will go into puberty earlier. Also, just access to foods. Who's more likely to have free lunch? And what's the quality of the food that kids are getting in their schools?
And are you able to look at things like role of media influences and things like that? These are questions parents often are asking.
You know, it's a great question. And we have not done a really extensive job of looking at the role of media. And in some ways, it's really hard to in this study because the media exposure is so ubiquitous amongst our girls. So we have talked about measuring it. But the question is, would you even get variable responses? Everybody is pummeled by these media images, these hypersexualized media images daily.
Right. And how reliable could the data be if the girls are self-reporting it? And,
sure.
You know, these are all the questions people wonder about. Well, Dr. Khushi, since you are involved in the actual, you know, looking at this one particular cohort of girls and trying to tease out some of these factors, maybe you could just share with us the findings at this point in time that seem really interesting to you.
So let me just continue on. Well, let me make a couple of initial points. One is that one of the key funders of this study is the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. And so from the beginning, one of the main things that we were looking at and our funders were interested in looking at was environment sort of in the way that most people think of it, you know, the chemicals that we're exposed to. And so as Louise mentioned, or as Dr. Greenspan mentioned, you know, we did explicitly collect blood and urine samples so we could analyze them for chemical exposures. We did ask the parents and the girls themselves about different products that they may use that may contain different types of chemicals, etc. And the interest has been on these chemicals that may influence hormone activity, these endocrine disruptor type chemicals. But let me circle back to Dr. Deardorff's comments and some of her interests in thinking about the environment. One of the things that she's identified in our study in an earlier analysis was that the family environment itself may influence onset of puberty. and she can talk more about that. But specifically, she published a paper which identified absence of a biological father in the household being associated with potentially earlier onset of puberty. And it's not unique to our study, this particular finding, but we did confirm that, you know, what other studies have observed there.
I thought that was so fascinating. Yeah, the idea that the absence of a biological father could be a factor that would be isolated as a possible trigger or a possible predictor. So maybe you could talk more about that, Dr. Dierdorf, and what you all sort of expostulate that might mean, you know?
Sure, yeah. And just to give some background, as a clinical psychologist, I came into this knowing that there had been other studies in the field that had shown that a biological father being absent led a girl to enter puberty early. And I thought, no way. That's very evolutionary. Let me think about that. And it's really interesting. We tried to tease apart some things like what the socioeconomic status of the family would be like, what the stress levels might be like in the home, given that mom is then on her own potentially and trying to pull together a meal that might be healthy. I mean, there's so many factors, and I do think there's more study to be done in this area, but it is a very consistent finding time and time again that if a bio father is not in the home, that girls tend to, on average, start at least menarche earlier, and our study was the first to show that that was true for breast development as well.
So you mentioned the evolutionary piece. I mean, obviously, it's going to take a lot more to really understand why that might be happening, but you could throw out there a thought if you've got any about that.
Sure. Well, there's a couple reasons that people have posited in the field, and of course they're theoretical. We can't do a natural experiment on this, it doesn't work that way. But one is that it's possible that a biological father in the home has some kind of a pheromonal effect on the daughter that actually suppresses puberty. And that once that's removed, that puberty is then released.
And when you mean pheromonal, like a scent?
Like a scent, right? Mm. So that's the folks who study animals jump on that immediately and think, you know what, that makes a lot of sense. That's what happens with animals. From a more psychosocial perspective, it may just be some of the things that are hard to measure and that are so entwined with living in poverty, single-parent families, a lot of dissonance in the environment that signals a body to reproduce earlier, to start the process of becoming reproductively ready earlier, because there's not a lot of stability in the environment. Mm-hmm. And that actually makes a lot of sense theoretically.
And is stress another thing that you can look at? And I know that there's interesting, you know, measurements now of stress amongst youth in particular. You can look at, you know, stress factors and almost kind of quantify them. So I'm wondering if that's something that you are trying to tease out.
And you know, we that hasn't been the focus of the study, as Dr. Cushy mentioned. We weren't funded under that rubric. There's been several studies that have done that looking backward in time retrospectively. We're hoping as we move forward that we might be able to move forward and look in a more current time at what's happening in the family and stressors. And we do have some of those data. We'd also be interested in looking at some of the biological markers of stress than to see how those correlate.
Okay. Well, coming back to this traditional definition of environmental, because I do think that this is where parents do become very concerned. And, you know, you start thinking, I've got to get rid of the couch and I've got to throw everything in the refrigerator. And what if my child drank out of a plastic baby bottle when they were a baby? And, you know, all of that. I'm wondering how much, I mean, you're just in data collection, but how much maybe you could share that, you know, how much do you know so far about that big question?
I think it's a good question. I'd like to take a step back to explain one concept in environmental science, and that is the concept of the precautionary principle. And the precautionary principle is a little bit different than how we regulate chemicals in the environment today. They have to be proven dangerous, and then they're withdrawn. And what the precautionary principle concept is that if you don't know if something's safe or not, and there is an alternative that you think is safe, then you would select the safe alternative. So when we don't know, we should try and do the things that we think might be better. We also have to do the best that we can with the knowledge that we have at the time. Mm-hmm. So for those parents of this generation who had baby bottles that had BPA in it, well, we didn't know any different. And because of that, we used the bottles that we used. And now people are trying to use the glass bottles or there's no BPA in them. So I think you just have to do what you can. But I think there are some things that are probably safe to do that you can minimize your risk. And we can talk about every single chemical along the way. But in general, the idea is if we were going to talk about BPA, you would try to use products that don't have it in there. I worry a little bit about some of the new plastics and what they have in
right.
them.
What don't we know so far yet, right?
But I think, for example, BPA. So do you buy water bottles and throw them away or recycle them? Or do you have a steel water bottle that you refill? Well, over time, it's a lot cheaper and a lot better for the environment, and it's probably better for your health. So why not do it because it's already better for those other reasons?
Mm-hmm.
The same could be said for whether people should eat organic fruits and vegetables. When I have people ask about that, my first comment is, please just eat fruits and vegetables. And I work with patients who are on very limited food budget or have food stamps. And just to get people to eat fruits and vegetables on that budget is a wonderful thing. And it's ridiculous to then say, but you have to do it with organic fruits and vegetables. So I think you have to do what you can. Organic fruits and vegetables are definitely better for the environment. They're probably better for humans. We don't have the definitive scientific data. So I think if you have that option, you buy organic fruits and vegetables. If you don't, you can buy just the dirty dozen. Just buy those organically. But if not, just eat fruits and vegetables.
All right. So you just mentioned the dirty dozen. Some people listening to the show may know what that means. Some may not. So just give us an example of a couple that are really important to know about.
So my resource for this, by the way, and I'll give a nice shout out to the Environmental Working Group, EWG.org. And they have a list of this that's constantly being updated. And I actually think Dr. Kushi is the best one to answer that question.
Oh, because you are the nutrition.
He is
person.
A nutritional epidemiologist.
Yes. Let's get Dr. Kushi's expertise into this conversation.
Yes. So what Louise is, Dr. Greenspan, I guess I should refer you more formally here, was referring to is the Environmental Working Group does, in fact, keep a list of those fruits and vegetables that tend to have the highest load of pesticides, herbicides, et cetera, when it actually arrives on your table when you're eating them. And so an example might be strawberries, for example, that tend to retain a lot of that. So those are things that, to the extent that if you can avoid those and eat them organically, that would be great. But obviously, as Louise said, I totally agree that, you know, what's more important is simply eating more fruits and vegetables. That's, that's a much better thing to do and not worry about whether it's organic or not. If you have the luxury of being able to consume organic and choose organic, then that's great. I'll point out that our study is one of the first that actually has tried to assess organic food consumption. One of the first questions we often have done as we were designing this study was whether organic milk, milk without bovine growth hormone, makes a difference in growth and pubertal onset. And so we decided that we needed to collect this information just because it was so salient to so many people. So we have assessed that, and we're starting to look at that relationship. I don't actually know what that relationship is yet, but it is something that we're interested in. Another factor, environmental factor in a sense, that we're exposed to from food, which is more intrinsic to the food as opposed to herbicides or pesticides, is isoflavone intake, which is particularly rich in soy foods. And they've been of a lot of interest for various reasons, but one of them is that they may have some weak estrogenic activity and therefore may influence estrogen metabolism, hormone metabolism. And so we're doing some analyses related to soy food intake and onset of puberty. Earlier on, we talked about the Asian girls in our study. And of course, Asian populations in general tend to eat more soy foods, which are the richest source of these isoflavones. And so along with the obesity that we've mentioned, it may be that some of these food choices, traditional food choices, may also influence age and onset of puberty. And so that's one of the things that we're looking at right now.
I think that's a really important one to mention. A lot of people don't realize that there is that question out there about soy. And my understanding is all of us eat a lot more soy than we used to because it's an additive mm-hmm. to a lot of different foods. And of course, the question, you get in your mind right now is, okay, do I drink the, do I have my kids drink the soy milk or do I have them drink the non, bovine growth hormone cow milk or, So, I'm sure all of you get people who ask you these questions, but, and maybe this comes back to the sort of, I know I don't remember the term you just
precautionary principle.
Thank you. Precautionary principle. But, you know, any advice out there for our listeners, Dr. Kashir, Dr. Greenspan, or Dr. Dierdorf, for what to do with all this information, I mean, knowing that you're in the midst of data collection, don't have any answers yet?
I think you do what you feel is right for your family. I think you don't overdo anything. So I wouldn't. I do think there's a difference between whole foods and foods that are processed. And Dr. Kushi definitely would agree with me on that and probably be able to speak about it more. For example, I think there's a difference between tofu, edamame, and soy milk versus food with soy protein isolate added into it. And in fact, and Dr. Kushi can speak about this more, the balance of the soy isoflavones is very different in the food that's a whole soy versus a food that's a processed food. But that would also be the same, I think, with the milk. If you can choose the milk that's hormone-free, I would. But you have to do what's right for your family. Are you lactose intolerant? Are you not?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's reasons to...
The difference is there. Yeah, Dr. Kushi, do you have any other, you know, sort of insights there? And it's always interesting to tease those differences out. It's not just the soy, but it comes often, these conversations come back to processed food. But I'd love to hear your thoughts there.
Yeah, so for other reasons, not necessarily related to pubertal onset, it's quite clear that, for example, for cardiovascular disease risk, that eating whole grains as opposed to refined grains and sugar, that makes a big difference. Dietary fiber intake, we know, decreases the likelihood of dying from cardiovascular disease. We know from glucose control and diabetes sort of prevention and management that the type of foods that we select, if they're more whole foods, makes a big difference. So for those reasons, you know, sort of even aside from possible effects on pubertal onset, there are compelling reasons that, you know, those types of food selections really does make a big difference. So I think that, you know, as Dr. Greenspan was mentioning, there are compelling reasons otherwise, and it may have beneficial effects in terms of perhaps not hastening the onset of puberty as well. I think a key point is that, as we've published in our recent paper, age of onset of puberty, or breast development in particular, is occurring earlier than before. But what that means is that, you know, sort of experiencing, if your daughter experiences velarche or first onset of breast budding, you know, at age 7 or 8, that's not necessarily abnormal. And so it's not something to be alarmed at, you know, necessarily. I think that's sort of one thing. You know, if the whole population is shifting a little bit earlier, then some girls are going to experience onset of breast development at a younger age. And so that's part of, as other people have mentioned, the new normal, so to speak.
Okay, great. We're going to actually talk about that next, and what sort of the implications of that new normal. But I want to just take a moment, remind everyone that we're listening to City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW in San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. And tonight we're discussing early onset of puberty in girls with three leading researchers from the Bay Area. We have Dr. Louise Greenspan of Kaiser Permanente, Dr. Juliana Dierdorf of UC Berkeley, and Dr. Lawrence Kushi, also of Kaiser Permanente. And we'd like to invite you, our listener, to join our conversation now. Are you a parent of a girl that's showing early signs of puberty? Are you a teacher who's noticing a trend towards early maturation in your classroom? Or do you have other questions for our guests about what may be causing early onset of puberty in girls? The number to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at cityvisions917@gmail.com or post a comment on KALW.org or on our Facebook page. So I want to talk a little bit about the implications of this new normal. And, you know, I think an easy place to go to is what happens in the classroom and in schools around sex ed in particular. And, you know, generally the coupling together of body changes and sort of sexual knowledge and sort of orientation that tends to go together in most ways that's taught to adolescents. And it seems like if we're looking at girls starting to kind of have body changes younger and younger, that it might imply a different approach is needed. And I don't know, Dr. Deirdre, if you want to start with giving us some ideas there, what your thoughts there.
Well, just, I mean, one thing I want to say is I first entered this field about 20 years ago. And what got me interested in it and inquisitive about it was I was teaching in a sixth grade classroom. Mm. And I looked at the girls in the sixth grade classroom, and there was so much variability in terms of how developed they were, how mature they were. And it was dramatic. Physically, it was dramatic. But not only physically, but socially and emotionally. And it wasn't always a connection between a girl's physical development and how socially and cognitively savvy she was at that age. And all these disconnects, if you put them together in a certain girl, could be a perfect storm. And so this was 20 years ago. And now we're seeing that puberty is starting earlier. But there's always been a lot of variability in terms of when kids go into puberty, how quickly they progress through puberty, and how it affects them emotionally, and how they compare themselves to their peers. So I just want to make that point. Mm-hmm. And I know Louise can really speak to some of the trends towards earlier puberty and whether we've talked long and hard
education.
About whether we think this is a new normal or how normal this is.
Yes. I think getting back to the question about puberty education, I think we're looking at something that's happening in third and fourth grade now. And sex ed happens in fifth or sixth grade, to my knowledge, in most school districts. So we're talking about an 8-year-old girls. I just want to throw out some numbers. 8-year-old girls, which is third or fourth grade. In the Caucasian girls, 16% have breast development. 43% of the black girls have breast development, and 31% of the Hispanic girls have breast development. So depending on your school district or the racial makeup of your class, you have a significant minority to almost the mean having breast development in third or fourth grade, and we're not teaching the kids about it till fifth or sixth grade. Mm-hmm. So I'm on this mission now. I feel like it's my new thing that I really believe we need to divide out what we're teaching kids, and we need to have health ed that's puberty ed, and hey, while we're at it, why don't we teach them about exercise and vegetables as well? Mm-hmm. But do puberty ed in third or fourth grade, and do sex ed maybe in fifth or sixth grade, and then we probably need repeat sex ed in 11th grade, right? And each of those subjects is different, because when the child first starts going through puberty, although the parents may be leaping to womanhood, the kid's not leaping there. They just want to know what's going on with me, and why does she wear a bra and I don't, or why am I wearing one and she's not, or do I need to wear a bra, and what is a bra, and what's a training bra? They need to have someone sit down and talk to them about that. Ideally, this is done in the home, but I do think that there's something to be gained from doing this in the group setting with their peers and to normalize it. So then, and you can teach that some of the kids in third grade are starting, some won't start till seventh grade. That 4-year span between age 7 or 8 and age 13 is a very long time. And we can't leave it till 60% of the girls have development. By sixth grade, 40% of the girls probably have their period. So I think we really need to separate out and have a critical reassessment of how we're teaching our children about their bodies. And maybe the boys don't need this till a little bit later, but I do think it should be gender specific and it should be earlier. And you can leave the sex out of it till they're in middle school.
And by the way, this is very salient for both Drs. Greenspan and myself, because we both have daughters
in this age range.
Right around this age range.
I do too, actually. She was embarrassed that I was doing this show.
And they should be asleep.
You should see how embarrassed our daughters are.
Mine should be in bed by now.
She said, I don't think I'm going to listen to it, Mommy. But yeah, no, and I think it is really fascinating to look at that. And there's just even, you know, hygiene and body care things, yes, that change once you start entering into, yeah, this stage that are very separate from needing to know,
absolutely,
about anything to do,
yeah,
with boys or anything,
yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
Dr. Cushy, is this something that you're working with the girls in your study around? Is there sort of a support component that comes into the play with, you know, the girls that you're studying?
Yeah, so from the beginning, one of the things that the study has been designed with, which is pretty unique in for NIH-funded studies, is that we've been working with what we call our Community and Outreach Translation Corps, and more specifically, that's been led by Zero Breast Cancer, which is a community advocacy group in Marin County, and their network of like-minded organizations in the Bay Area. And so from the beginning, we have held what we initially called P-Talks, and now we call Teen Talks, in which we've invited all of our study participants to attend events at different Bay Area venues, where we've then talked with the parents or the girls themselves about different aspects of the study and, you know, what we're looking at. More recently, one of the relatively unique things we've done, there are other studies that have done this, but we're one of the few, is we actually have created a youth advisory board for the study. And so this consists of about 20 girls who are actually participants in the study who have been advising us about how we're doing things, and we've been telling them more about, you know, the research process and why we're looking at different aspects. And so it's been much more of a sort of a joint sort of collaboration of our study participants with us as researchers. And so that sort of back and forth has really been pretty inspirational, at least for me as a researcher, to listen to our now pretty mature study participants, you know, really tell us about, you know, some of the things that we've been, you know, asking about. You know, they're curious as to why they've provided suggestions on different topics or ways in which we should ask questions to their peers in the study. Mm. And so that type of that, both of those aspects are unique, I think, relatively unique in the whole world of conducting these types of—
That's neat. It's a lot of integrity to be able to listen to the girls that you're studying and give them a voice. That's a very unique, mm-hmm. I think. And what an amazing opportunity for those girls. We have a caller on the line. I'd love to go to our caller now. We have Karen from Oakland. Thank you for calling City Visions Radio, Karen.
Well, thank you for allowing me to ask this question, because it's something I've been curious about for years. I have a daughter who's now 20, and she's been raised a vegetarian. When she was around 10, she participated in a study that was dealing with soy consumption and onset of menses, I think. I actually can't recall the exact study. However, early onset of puberty was something that had always interested me, because as a medical anthropologist, I was curious whether any of these studies have been conducted cross-culturally to look not just at American girls, but at girls of other cultures that do not have hormones in their meat. For example, in France or in other countries. In France, they don't allow growth hormones. And what is the comparison between early onset of puberty in countries like France and Germany and the United States?
That's a great question. Dr. Kushi, with your nutrition expertise, I would love to have you take the first stab at that.
Yeah, so in fact, there is some variation internationally in terms of age at menarche, and there's been much less work on age at filarche, or breast development. Yes, there do appear to be some of these differences in terms of the average age. A really interesting paper and analysis that recently came out looking at filarche looked specifically at people for three different populations, people who were in Bangladesh and then people in England who had migrated from Bangladesh. And interestingly, the age of filarche, so to speak, age of breast development, was in fact earlier among the population in England. Despite the fact that sort of culturally and sort of, you know, genetic stock, generally speaking, was similar in these two populations. And so that's something that was one of the first observations. We earlier talked about the fact that African-American girls have been shown to develop breast development earlier than the white girls, in not just our study, but other studies as well. Actually, if you look at some observations, for example, in South Africa, you actually see the opposite. So there does appear to be compelling cultural and environmental factors that probably play into some of these differences that we see.
That's a great— it's very interesting that about the Bangladesh and England. That one's really interesting. You could just imagine all the different things that might be related to. And Dr. Greenspan, mm-hmm. do you have anything to add there about the cross-cultural question?
Well, I mean, I think it's important to note that at least menarche decreased in other countries that were also industrialized and developed. And we've seen some evidence of onset of puberty starting earlier in other countries as well. So this trend is happening, and I think really what we're trying to get at, and other studies are too, is what are the environmental triggers? Because I think it's clear that there are environmental triggers and that the body's very adaptive. It senses all these things out in the environment and that it will adapt.
And I think one point is that we talk about African Americans going through puberty earlier, and obviously African Americans have a very diverse genetic background, but African girls are not going through puberty earlier. So it's not, you can't say, oh, there's a genetic difference, really, because there's, it's really most likely in the environment of our girls that are African American here.
Now, that's not to say that there might not be a gene environment difference.
Sorry. Yes, right. Okay. Yeah. So, oh, sorry, Karen, did you have one other thing to add there?
With your category of African American girls, are you looking at just race, or are you also looking at education, where people are living,
yes,
and socioeconomic status? Because with African American girls, are the upper class girls going through puberty at the same rate as the lower class girls whose diet consists of junk food? I assume I'm being very making these gross generalizations.
Right.
Here.
A lot of
inexpensive chicken.
Right. So looking at the connection between socioeconomic and race. So, Dr. Deirdre, if you were going to add something.
I just think it goes back to the point I was making before. It would take a very specific type of study in the United States to disentangle some of these socioeconomic factors from race, because we live in a country, unfortunately, where there are pockets of poverty and folks who are ethnic minorities live in them.
Mm-hmm.
But that is what gives me pause and makes me think we really need to dig into this and figure out what's going at a structural level, what we need to do in terms of potential policy implications downstream.
Great. Okay. Thanks, Karen. Thanks so much for
Thank
the
you.
Call.
Bye.
Speaking of, Dr. Cushy, were you going to add something there?
Yeah, just one brief thing. We have collected information on some of those socioeconomic parameters, educational status, household income, and also things like country of origin and some other things like that. So even though we can't do definitive analyses looking at all these different interactions of these different factors, we do have the ability to actually start to tease apart some of that. So I think that, I think we can we'll at least be in a position to shed a little bit of light on, okay, is it really, sort of race? Oh, I should say we've collected some biological samples, so we can actually look at genetic factors and genetic admixture.
And anticipating in later studies you're going to be able to correlate all that sort of data. I think what Dr. Judith was talking about is the literal isolation of these factors kind of research environment, which would not probably be possible. I just want to give one more quick overview of what we're talking about tonight at the City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW in San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. And tonight we're talking about early onset of puberty in girls with three leading researchers from the Bay Area, Dr. Louise Greenspan of Kaiser Permanente, Dr. Lawrence Cushy, also of Kaiser Permanente, and Dr. Juliana Deerdorf of UC Berkeley. If you'd like to call or join our conversation with a question about early onset of puberty in girls and why girls are maturing younger and younger, and all the environmental factors that might be causing that to happen, we'd love to hear from you. Our phone number is 415-841-4134, 415-841-4134, or you can email us at cityvisions917@gmail.com, or post a comment on KALW.org or on our Facebook page. I just wanted to you mentioned the term downstream, Dr. Deirdorf, and I think it's interesting, that this study came out of this question about breast cancer, and that is a downstream concern. Are there sort of psychosocial things that you see that come out of this early onset of puberty? And I don't want to put you on the spot if you don't have something definitive to say about it, but I'm just, as a parent, you kind of wonder, okay, well, if my daughter goes this early and boys look at her differently, is she going to then in kind respond differently, see herself as more sexual earlier than she would have if she had started to develop later? And would that cause her to behave in a different way and have certain kind of risks or adverse, impacts of that? I'm wondering if you know anything about that question.
Well, sure. The girls in our study are still relatively young in terms of the data we have entered. We haven't been able to look at those things, but we do intend to look at some of the downstream psychological effects. And, You know, what the research with the literature generally says is that it's not a bright line from early puberty to negative outcomes, at least in the psychological or mental health realm, that it really seems to depend on a girl's context. So the friends that she hangs out with, the quality of her relationships, quality of her the parents and the family environment, what's going on in her schools, what kinds of vulnerability she may bring in terms of like a proclivity for depression or things like that, that may come from a genetic predisposition, those kinds of things. There's a lot of factors that bundle together. And so what I always tell parents is just because your daughter's going through puberty early does not mean that it's going to lead to this cascade of negative events. Now, yes, the literature shows she's at higher risk. So what are you going to do about it, right? You're going to keep the lines of communication open. You're going to make sure that you know who she's hanging out with, set some firm limits to show that you care. All those things that we know that good parenting is. Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's another issue going on now that this is the new normal, so to speak. When you used to have an 8-year-old with breast development, she might have been one of 5% of the girls who had breast development. Now she's one of 43% of the girls who have breast development. So how does that change your experience when you're that young, if you're surrounded by peers that are going through the same thing? So perhaps being an early bloomer isn't so bad when everyone else is an early bloomer. Mm. And there may still be biological effects that we need to be considering. But I think if everyone else around you is going through a similar process, then maybe it's not quite so much of a trauma. But I think the other question is, we don't know how long puberty's lasting now. Right. So we used to say it was 2 to 3 years. So the girls that started at 8 were going to get their periods at 10 and a half or so. That's our next big step, because is puberty lasting longer? And that in itself would then be this process now being 4 years, but if everyone else is going through it, I think that may dampen some of the negative psychological ramifications.
And do pediatricians just make that assumption? You know, if they feel that early breast bud, do they say to the parents, oh, by the way, 2 years from now, your child's going to get their period? Or is that sort of in an 8-year-old kind of suspended a little bit?
No, people do ask, because people, I think parents are really concerned when they realize the girl has breast development. Mm-hmm. They leap to all these other places, right? So I think it's really important. They go to periods, they go to, as we said before, sex. And I think that it's very reassuring sometimes when you can say, you know, she's in fourth grade and she's got breasts. I don't think she's going to get her period till middle school, sixth or seventh grade. That's actually very comforting.
Yes.
Because again, I think the people they don't understand the connection between these two events. So 8's completely normal. I mean, now, unfortunately, 7 is normal. But even those 7-year-old girls probably won't get their periods till 10, which has always been the age of cutoff of normal. So we don't worry about them as much.
So we just think it's going to extend out the period.
That's my hypothesis. I may be proven wrong.
That's right. You have yet to. That'll be the
yes,
next thing.
Yes, I'll come back in a couple of years and tell you about that.
We'll get you back.
But the control that the parent has is not to sexualize the development, right? So as a parent, you know, you don't want to jump to oh, my daughter's becoming sexual in your mind when she's not even there yet, because you're going to suggest things that aren't even part of it.
Or dressing and all of those
things.
Yes.
I often talk to my patients. I'll say to them, you know, in your family, your parents have the decision about what you wear, what you watch, what you read, and who you hang out with. And just because you're 9 and you look 12 does not mean you can wear 12-year-old clothes.
Yes.
The problem is, and I speak from personal experience as the mother of a daughter, it is so hard now to buy age-appropriate clothes. Mm-hmm. And we were in one name-brand store, and there was this off-the-shoulder tiger leopard print thing my daughter wanted when she was 5. It was something a 16-year-old probably shouldn't wear. And she said she wanted it. And I said very loudly, oh, honey, X store, I'll leave it nameless. They made a mistake. They're stocking teenage clothes. And the two moms next to me just started laughing. But it was clearly an inappropriate outfit.
Yes. And anyone who has a daughter would say it's not just X store, it's X many stores.
Yes.
That you have that experience in, or at least I certainly do. But yeah, I think that, and to be clear that those choices are still there. We probably have time for one more just quick conversation, and then I want to give you all a chance to close. We got an email from a listener who asked about an article that was in the New York Times Magazine a few weeks ago about boys. Mm-hmm. And about, it was not a scientific study. Mm-hmm. She was looking at a boys' choir in Germany and the age of the sopranos that used to be 15 to 16, and now they're 8 and 9 years old. So this listener was wondering if the same early onset of puberty phenomenon has been marked in boys, too, or noticed in boys, too. Obviously, this is not your study, but just if you know the literature out there. And then also, the article made this point that this has been, in this looking at this one choir that's been going on for 800 years or something, slow uptick mm-hmm. over such a gigantically long period mm-hmm. of time that... So I guess there's two parts to this question. Is this happening for boys, too? And is this evolution? Do you think it goes back even farther than, you know?
Yeah. I'd like to answer the second question first.
Yeah.
I think that if we look at the large scale of humanity, and I do know that article, it was a wonderfully written article describing the phenomenon, and they do have records that are showing that voices are breaking earlier. We are looking at a population that up to 200 years ago, in the classic sense, was probably poorly nourished. So you had boys that may have had, quote, delayed puberty because they were malnourished in their villages before they were brought in mm-hmm. to be there. So I think the problem with looking at that 800-year-old history of the choir is for 600 years, by today's standards, they didn't have the right balance of nutrition and calories. And we know that that causes you to go through puberty later. So that then speaks to this first question, which is, how long has this been going on? Well, when you have malnourishment and you go to a time of correct nourishment, the age of puberty will drop. And you can see that in people that are ill. Children that are systemically ill don't go through puberty. That's a delayed phenomenon. In a population basis, if there's poor nutrition, the population will go through puberty later. What we have is now we've gone beyond that to the state of overnutrition. So when you go into then with 30% of kids being overweight or obese, that's pushing the age down earlier because fat is an endocrine organ. However, it mostly secretes the kind of hormones that put girls through puberty. So obesity and boys has made it a very confusing picture in boys. So some of the studies suggest that obesity makes boys go through puberty late. Some of the studies suggest that obesity makes boys go through puberty early. Mm. I think that it's probably happening with boys earlier. I think it's probably a phenomenon that's hitting them 10 years later than it's hitting girls. Mm-hmm. My suspicion is that it's from a lot of the data coming out of Europe, and there's some really good studies, that it probably is happening a little bit earlier. But it's not quite as clear-cut as it is in the girls.
Interesting. And I'm wondering if that study that Dr. Cushy mentioned about the Bangladeshi, if population moving to England and the earlier onset of puberty in those folks mm-hmm. is related to the nutrition, too, mm-hmm. probably. Mm-hmm.
That's one hypothesis. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know, Dr. Dierdorf or Dr. Cushy, just a quick thought on this boy part of the puberty puzzle.
I think it's very interesting, and it's really understudied. And a recent study did just come out to show that boys in some ways are experiencing onset of puberty earlier. And I know both Dr. Cushy and I and Dr. Greenspan are interested in looking into this more in future studies.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's a future NIH grant out
we
there.
We hope.
We have time just for quick closing comments, and I'd love to hear from each one of you. Just any closing thoughts and anything that we can look forward to learning next from the study and in our last 2 or 3 minutes here.
Do you want to let Dr. Cushy, would you like to say something?
Would you like to land the plane for us first, Dr. Cushy?
Sure. Well, first of all, I want to thank you for focusing in on this particular project and allowing us to be on the air. And more importantly, I'd like to thank all our study participants, if any of them are listening, and their families for inviting us to be part of their growing up experience, so that without them, you know, none of this would be possible. And so those, I'd like to, you know, really thank everybody who's been involved in this study in any way that's really helped create this knowledge.
Great.
And as we've mentioned, we're going to be publishing a series of papers looking at different environmental factors probably over the next several months. So those are things that people should be.
Okay. More to come. Dr. Dierdorf or Dr. Greenspan, just real quickly, anything else?
I'm going to advocate that we need to be teaching these kids about their bodies in puberty earlier than we are.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry, Dr. Dierdorf, we're running out of time here. I have to close.
That's okay. It was a pleasure being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to City Visions Radio. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, please visit us City Visions page on KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was Kevin Vance. Tonight's show was produced by me, with in-studio work by guest producer, KAL listener and supporter Shelley Sutherland. Thanks, Shelley. We're going to have a rebroadcast next week of City Visions Radio, and we will look forward to seeing you back on the air in a few weeks. This is Victoria Thorpe. Thanks for listening. Good night, and have a great week.